Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host and great friend, Janie Andy Anderson. Welcome to Talk About with Rez and Andy, and our special guest, Zach Scow, the founder of Marley's Mutts, an international dog rescue, saving the lives of thousands of unwanted dogs and finding new homes where they can be safe and loved. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Welcome, Sarah.
Howdy.
Hey there.
We are good.
We're good, and we're so happy to have you on. It's a real honor. What you've done for dogs, we are dog lovers ourselves, horse lovers, dog lovers, and what you've done has been spectacular. So we're very honored to have you at the show today.
I appreciate that. That's like the best intro I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah. It's very deserved.
I'm sure not.
Very deserved.
Zach, your story is intriguing on its own merit, just without what you've done. But the thing that drew you to dogs, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your backstory and why you're doing all of this with Marley's Mutts?
Yeah, I sure can. My liver failed, along with my kidneys, in 2008 due to end-stage liver disease brought on by acute alcoholic hepatitis. So I drank and drugged my liver and kidneys into failure at 28 years old. And after many months in the hospital and coming as close to death as you can over a period of, again, many months with zero hope, my rescue dogs, you know, helped me get up out of bed on the road to recovery, literally walking on the road up here in the mountains, which is where I still live. And with their help, you know, I was able to heal spiritually, physically, emotionally. And as far as I know, I'm still enrolled and I'm still a comprehensive transplant patient. There has been nobody else in our program there at Cedars-Sinai that has been able to recover from this type of illness and not need a liver transplant and have essentially reversed their affliction.
Wow.
So you had a real epiphany.
But you didn't need the transplant.
No. I was, when you're end, they call it end stage because you either die or you get a liver transplant. But you need 6 months of sobriety to qualify for a liver transplant. They do not give away livers to people who are not. It's a minimum requirement. You have to have a supportive family. You have to have 6 months sobriety. And I was too sick to receive transplant, and I needed 6 months sobriety. So when I got out of the hospital, after I got admitted into the comprehensive transplant program, the directions from my doctor were, you need to get healthy enough, you need to walk, because I had this condition called ascites. Well, when your liver fails, you basically become pregnant. You know, your belly button herniates, and you have this huge belly. You look 9 months pregnant with twins. And, you know, I had a catheter in my back, which would drain that huge belly. It's full of blood and bile because your liver is, all the blood that's being pumped through your liver is just emptying into the nearest cavity, which is your belly. So, I needed to try and work off that condition. I had preliminary esophageal varices, which is another condition where causes you to vomit blood, consistently. And if those varices rupture, you bleed out through your mouth.
Yes.
And your blood isn't healthy enough to clot. I mean, there are a million ways you die from liver failure. I don't know if we have time to go into all of them. But what happened with the dogs was, you know, I needed to be spiritually well enough to even try to get physically well enough. And when I got out of the hospital, I had so many things wrong with me. I had never lived without alcohol and drugs. I was scared of everything around me, people, places, things. The wind, you know, everything. I had no idea how to live sober, and I was terrified. And my dogs helped, you know, after much poking and prodding, really after just waking up every morning and seeing my dogs so excited at the possibilities that, you know, with their wagging tails, is, what are we going to do today, Dad? Are we going to go for a walk? Are we going to go down to the lake? What do you want to do? You want to play fetch? You know, there's all these options, and they were stoked about everything, you know, and they looked at me like I was the world's greatest human being. And I felt like the world's crappiest human being.
Now, Zach, you did work with your father's dogs. Is that correct?
And was one of them Marley?
Yeah. Yeah, they're actually my dogs, but I was living with my dad at the time. Mm-hmm. It's hard to not be dependent on your father when you're as committed to alcoholism and drug addiction as I was. But yeah, the three dogs, I was doing work with the Humane Society before I got sick. Really more of just a self-serving way to feel better about myself. It wasn't, I don't think it was that pure. It was, I just wanted to not feel so terrible. And so I started a large dog foster program with the Humane Society. But the three dogs that helped save me are Buddy, Tug, and Marley. And they all came from Stray or from the Kern County Animal Shelter here in Kern County. And they're all still alive and well. They're getting on in years. Marley's 13, so is Tug. Wow. And Buddy's about 10.
Now, what breeds are these dogs, Zach?
Marley is about as studly as they get. He's a Rottweiler pit bull. He's about 95 pounds. He's just a looker, man. And he's the
big guy that you have pictures with.
Well, that might be Baloo. I have some pictures with Marley and some with Baloo. Baloo lives with me now. Marley's kind of retired. He was my pack general for several years. And, you know, it's hard work being the pack general with so many dogs. So he's retired and lives at my dad's house down the street. And Baloo is my new pack general.
I want to get into then how that translated then to you getting into Marley's mutts. But since we're talking about your house right now, how many dogs do you have at your house, rescue dogs?
I have six at the moment. So we have a huge foster network. So almost all of our dogs are kept in foster homes throughout Kern County, from Ridgecrest all the way to Button Willow and Wasco. So up here, you know, at the quote-unquote rescue, there really isn't a need to have that many dogs, and plus we're not really in an area that where it would be conducive. I have 3 acres and plenty of room, but we send dogs here that have had bite history, that have aggression issues, and we work with them up here. So right now I have 3 pit bulls, one Italian Mastiff, one French Mastiff with no tongue named Hooch, and one Brazilian Mastiff. And one of the pit bulls has 3 legs, and one of the other pit bulls has been shot 3 times. She took 3 40 caliber gunshots to the chest. And lived to tell about it.
Lived.
Now, well, Zach, I have followed you again on Facebook feed, and tell us a little bit about Hooch, the dog with no tongue.
Well, Hooch came from, all of our dogs come from the Kern County Animal Control, most of them, whether it's the city shelter or the county shelter. So we essentially show up with our group or just me, or just Amanda, who's our coordinator, and we rescue who we can. Usually we get pointed in that direction by the staff, so we try and rescue who the staff wants us to based on the time they've been there, based on injuries, based on, you know, unadoptability, the chances that they're not going to get saved at the shelter. So Hooch, very interesting dog. He had his ears recently cropped, and we didn't know what was wrong with him at first. He's an orange, you know, big orange bear. He's a French Mastiff. Something was wrong with him. He had some lacerations on his tongue. You know, he was pushing his food around in his bowl, and he wouldn't eat, but he was making a mess of it. He was also water aggressive, so they'd go to rinse out the kennel, and he'd, like, attack the hose. So no one knew what was wrong with him, but we committed to rescue him. He had viral pneumonia, so we had to wait over a week before we could bring him to the hospital, because you can't, unless you have really good quarantine, it's difficult to take a dog with that contagious of a condition. So when we finally got him out of there, he had continued to lose weight, you know, so he didn't even weigh 50 pounds. And so he was just crazy skinny. And so we took him to the vet to get some x-rays, see if he had a mass inside of him, see what was causing this extreme skinniness. And as soon as we put him under and went to intubate, you know, you usually move the tongue over to put the tube down their throat, and there's no tongue, nothing to move out of the way. And so his tongue had been removed when his ears had been removed. He's right at the base of the epiglottis, so he has no tongue at all, and no ears, but that's not a problem. So we feed him. He ate through an esophageal feeding tube for the first couple weeks, and just like dogs do, he said, "I've had enough," and he ripped the thing out. And we started feeding him in a Bailey's chair, which is like something that keeps them propped up on their back feet to keep their windpipe kind of straight and to let gravity do its trick. But it was only a couple of days before we had a total feeding routine down, and it's been very easy ever since. We just feed him by hand in the morning and usually at night, and he's great.
So when you started, when you were basically rehabilitating yourself and the dogs were doing the work. But somewhere really that switched and you started wanting to give back to the dogs. And how did that all start?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, you know, how it all unfolded because, you know, each of us is led to dog rescue in it by a different way. And none of us went to college with a degree in dog rescue or, you know, we all get led to dog rescue through a different way. And mine just happened so organically, you know, the dogs helped me get out of bed and start walking. I couldn't walk but 10 feet, 15 feet in the beginning. I couldn't do one squat, couldn't do a push-up, you know, but they got me journaling, you know, I needed to write about how I felt. They got me up every morning at sunrise so I could start hearing the birds chirp. I started to absorb beauty and I started to live vicariously through them, you know. When you're surrounded by your dogs, I mean, their body pressure when I went to bed, because I couldn't sleep, I was in a constant state of panic and terror, really, and very sick, very, very sick. Mm-hmm. That body pressure from my dogs was everything. And so, you know, it got to the point, I mean, Tug didn't even come in the house the whole time I was in the hospital. That's what my dad would tell me. He goes, son, you got to, if not for me, you got to come home, goddammit, because I need Tug to come in the house. You know, and so now whenever I see Tug or whenever I leave, he loses his mind. So what happened was, we just got to walking. We got to walking every day, you know, every single day. And then we got to jogging, as the months went by and we got to running. And then, by the time 6 months came around, I had started back up. 6 months is when I'm eligible for transplant. So but a couple months before that, when I started to get physically better, I wanted to start to give back and got back in with the Tehachapi Humane Society and started taking on one dog at a time, just one foster dog to bring into my crew. Marley proved to be an incredible pack general. So these dogs were scared, neurotic, you know, sometimes aggressive, sometimes just need to feel part of a pack, need to be able to let down their hair. And Marley, he provided that. He's such a, that symbiotic harmony you need, that calm energy that you need to have in a pack, he provided that. And he was very non-aggressive. When we'd have perturbations, like a fight, he would charge the two dogs, bump them with his chest, and then kind of stand there and make sure they stopped it. It was like watching a human break up a fight.
It's amazing. Cool. Absolutely amazing.
So with his help, we were like, shoot, you know, this is, we're onto something here. Because most of the other rescues that we observed, they all took small dogs where behavior usually isn't an issue. Let's be honest, people don't put any behavioral, or people don't put a lot of stock in behavioral training for little dogs. They just let them behave however they want. So we, and these other, you know, other organizations tend to take dogs from the shelter and then put them in another kennel environment, and this is just creating more post-traumatic stress, more potential for separation anxiety, more potential for lack of trust. You know, you're going to have to go through more to rehabilitate that dog if you take it from one cage and put it in another. So it was really, really cool to watch how quickly these dogs adapted from the shelter to a foster environment. And then I would start, you know, I'd take pictures of them, and I started to write these really quirky, funny biographies, you know, about each dog. They're just, I'm telling, I'm tooting my own horn, but they're hilarious. So I needed to try and be different, you know, through the images and through my writing to try and stick out. And it worked tremendously. I had several places around town. I just peppered the town. And people would go and read my posters and just gather around it. I had one spot by the library and one by Baskin and Robbins. And you'd go by there and there would be six or seven people standing just reading the bios and looking at the pictures. Because as you guys know, you know, that's one of the tragic flaws what needs to be changed from a shelter standpoint and from a rescue standpoint is marketing. They need to be able to advertise these dogs and let people see what they're actually, what kind of beauty they have. And you got to put a story to them and you got to put life to them. It can't just be some blurry picture where you tell them how much they weigh and what kind of breed it is. You know, you got to make it a living, breathing soul that can even be funny, or that can be tragic, or they can be victorious and triumphant. You know, you gotta infuse something that when the reader, the potential adopter sees it, they go, oh, that's my dog. That's what I gotta have. You know.
But when you brought these dogs into your home, were you, because I see pictures of you sleeping with them too and doing things real hands-on, touching, you know, and is that part of the rehabilitation?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for me personally, up here at the rescue, you know, I have a roommate now too who's up here to assist me with, because you need assistance when you have, you know, powerful dogs around. The key is to put them in a variety of situations and see how they react, you know, and then hopefully be able to address it from there. If you can, if there is a kind of look at it like an engineer, you know, what's the dog's problem? What do we need to work on? And, you know, how do we do so? So, that's what we try to do.
Okay.
We're not always successful. It's tough. You know, it really is tough, but, you know, like for instance, Diamond, who sleeps with myself or Chris, or like Splinter, who was up here, who would sleep with, we needed to make sure that, well, sometimes it's just a matter of convenience. You get tired of hearing the dogs bark, and you're like, all right, you can come in, gosh darn it. but other times, you know, we need to make sure we're not aiding or enabling some kind of bad behavior. You know, so if like, for instance, if Diamond had separation anxiety that was preventing her from being adoptable, we wouldn't allow her to sleep in the room. She'd have to learn boundaries. And also that she doesn't get everything she wants. There, you know, it has to be boundaries, you know, limitations. Affection comes at the end, you know. Affection is not the first thing you do. That's one thing I've learned that's really important, is if you can't correct a dog, you can't help a dog through only affection, because most often these dogs have so many issues. They're so scared that just providing affection for them can often encourage whatever state of mind they're in. I mean, when you pet a dog and you say nice things to it, or you give it affection when it's scared, terrified, or overly excited, you encourage that behavior. You know, so it's important to know what you're looking for. You know, some people might even view when they first come up here as an unintimate experience, because we, much like at Caesar's place, you know, Caesar Milan's place, we don't like to make eye contact right immediately. We don't like to touch the dogs immediately. We don't want you to talk to them. You know, you need to focus on understanding dog psychology so that you can make a difference. If you try to apply people's psychology to dogs, you're not going to have any results. You're going to have bad results.
Okay.
The dogs aren't going to be okay. They're going to get in fights, and they're going to not be adoptable, and then nobody wins.
Yeah, now, Zach, I do follow Caesar Milan. Do you know him personally? And second part of this question is, you do have to talk a little bit. I consider your little dog Splinter almost a poster child.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Caesar personally. We've done a lot of work at the Dog Psychology Center, and he's helped out with several of our dogs that have had, you know, really serious, you know, excitable aggression issues. One of whom was a dog fighting dog that was chained on county property named Nacho. And you know, he's such a powerful dog. He's almost 100 pounds, and he's pure muscle. Without his help, we would not have been able to get that dog to a place where he's adoptable. Now he's up here with me, and he's doing excellent, and I can have him around kids, people with no fear. He still has some issues with dogs, but it's not nearly as bad as it was. It's very, very manageable. And as far as Splinter goes, you know, it's funny. If you follow us long enough, that we've had several poster childs, and we'll have another one. We have another one right now, you know, Skyler. It happens. Kern County is a hotbed for hot messes. You know what I mean? We have so many problems, from dog hoarding to dog fighting to really just a lack of attention being paid to this county's problem, that the storylines are endless. There are so many dogs that need help. There are so many dogs in awful predicaments, which means there are so many opportunities to be of assistance. You know, I one of the problems that we have in the rescue world is there's a lot of competition. There's a lot of negative talk. There's a I'm not trying to generalize by any means. It's just what I've experienced, especially, you know, in places like Los Angeles. And if they would just look north to Kern County, you know, we have an endless supply of dogs, very adoptable dogs, and we have less rescues than we do shelters. You know, where we got like 4.5 rescues here. They have hundreds in Los Angeles, and we have 9 shelters.
Wow.
So There's just always a Hooch or a Skyler or a Splinter, you know, or a Bad Chad or a Baloo or a Maggie. They're out there, and it would take, you know, a couple hours to find another one. You know, they're just everywhere.
And you're also going into Korea now and rescuing dogs in Korea.
Yeah. Yeah. Korea and Thailand and Iran. And, that's an interesting, I'm not sure what there's a question there. I could talk about it for a long time. You might want to point me in a direction. We're rescuing dogs from outside of Seoul, Korea that are part of the meat trade. And we're rescuing dogs through the Soy Dog Foundation, who are part of the meat trade in Thailand. The organization we work with in Korea is called Save Korean Dogs, and the director, her name is Nami Kim, and she's just a great lady. We get a lot of heat from it because, you know, we have such a problem here in Kern County. A lot of people think, why are you working on saving dogs in Thailand when, you know, Oildale in Bakersfield need help? You know, that's your focus. Mm-hmm. Why are you turning your attentions away? And first of all, we always have about 35 dogs, and about 4 of them will be from out of the country. So the vast majority of our attention is on local dogs and local shelters. Mm-hmm. But when you have, you know, 330,000 people following you on Facebook and you have a weekly reach of 2.5 million, we have the ability to make change, to facilitate change.
Definitely.
Dr. Grossman, who is the founder of the Grossman Burn Centers all over the United States, you know, he helped us put together a couple of severely burned dogs, the worst burns that any animals have ever incurred and survived. And when he was asked, it's something I'll never forget, when they asked him, you know, why did you do this? They spent probably over $1 million in just their labor on this, and then all kinds of stuff on top of that, medical expenses and tools and, you know, non-cellular fetal bovine skin grafts. And he said, the answer was very simple. He said, Dr. Grossman, why did you put so much effort into this? Why did you spend so much money? Why did you do this? You know, and he said, because we could.
Mm-hmm. You know, now, Zach, reading on this meat trade situation, which I think is really interesting, how internationally people are really, really getting involved, protesting and denouncing this worldwide, that stats show 900,000 to 1 million dogs are taken and killed, for at least in Korea, for the meat trade. And have you experienced any government resistance in getting involved with this curtailing
of
this practice? Good. Okay.
No, not
good.
At all.
Good.
Well, I mean, as far as Korea specifically, the gal that Nami and her group that we work with there, you know, it's all legal. And the Korean government, it's illegal to consume, you know, dogs. They have, the rules are just not enforced very well. And it's a pretty widespread practice in the outlying areas around Seoul. And then when you get into the countryside, so trying to police it is pretty difficult. And it's just one of those stubborn cultural phenomenon that just end up sticking around. You know, I don't know what metaphorically what I can compare it to, but, you know, it's stubborn. And it really isn't. It's not like you go to Korea and you go to the McDonald's and there's an option for dog meat, a dog burger. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be 0.02% of the population. It's a very, very small, you know, percent of the population that engage in this, which we should recognize. But it is still a stubborn cultural phenomenon that people engage in for ridiculous reasons. You know, the primary reason they eat dog soup, which has just come into season because it's summer, is because they believe it helps regulate their body temperature, meaning stay cool when it's hot, which is ridiculous. And those dogs are called Nurongi, which is a different type of dog. And then they consume Jindos, a larger dog that has more meat, you know, just like a steak. And it's consumed for meat purposes, but also because they, you know, believe it has, it helps with virility, you know, typical stuff like shark fin soup, or like people that are snorting rhino horns or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They say it's gonna
folk remedies.
Gonna help them better. Yeah. So yeah, we're trying to help by mobilizing the people on our Facebook and just educating the people in Kern County who follow us and people elsewhere who follow us that's what's going on, and then putting a face to it, you know, showing them our dogs like Ringo and our dogs like little Zach. You know, and little Zach is in the hospital right now. He might have a congestive kidney problem or a congenital kidney problem, which comes from being bred in these farms. They're all bred in farms. They're taken, they grow up in chicken coops, and they're taken to restaurants and to slaughterhouses, and they're either boiled or they're slaughtered. And the practice is really tough to describe without, especially if you've seen the images, it's tough, you know, and it forces you to look at your meat consumption in general, you know, big time. I mean, I've had a serious, you know, like, problem with my own, you know, meat consumption and how this applies to, am I being hypocritical? And, you know, so I've tried to make proactive steps to limit my meat consumption. But it's just, there's something about the canine-human bond. There's something about what, you know, what we've established over hundreds of thousands of years of contact with dogs, or at least tens of thousands of years, where, you know, we look at a dog and we see ourselves. Dogs have the ability to heal us. They have the ability to bring us joy. They have the ability to do so much for us that's why it rings true to all of us, and that's why it affects all of us down to our some of our worst places, you know.
Mm-hmm. How many volunteers do you have, Zach, to help you do all this?
Well, we have a staff. You know, when you get into dealing with as much stuff as we do, you need to start hiring people. So we have a staff of 5, you know, one person that operates our Miracle Mutts program, which is our educational program. Mm-hmm. Her name's Liz Cover. She's awesome. She's got several degrees in canine behavior and canine assisted activities. And Kim Cordero is our spay-neuter director, because we do, you know, like $100,000 worth of low-cost spay-neuter every year. We spayed and neutered about 2,000 dogs last year.
Wow.
That's a big number.
Rescue rehab program, and Amanda Brooks is her name. She's our coordinator for that program. And so from a volunteer standpoint, you know, we have so many, we have probably 100-something registered foster homes. So those are homes that have passed background checks and that are actively involved in helping us transport, helping us foster. So the real volunteers are people that come out to events and help us do events, and then foster homes. You know, foster homes are key for us. Moving forward, you know, what we're really trying to do is create an environment, provide an environment, you know, a physical place where we can all come together, have really good foster orientations where people can learn skills and trades. A lot of this stuff I learned from Caesar. People think Caesar's just somebody who, you know, pokes dogs and says, shh. But what he knows from a behavioral standpoint, as far as helping scared dogs and turning them around, is really, really beneficial. And also just simple leash technique that he knows, and, you know, getting dogs to, it's been profoundly effective. And so looking forward, that's what I want to do, is just help create kind of an army of people that have the basic skills to help rehabilitate rescue dogs, and just keep doing what we're doing. You know, we try to educate as much as we can. Our Miracle Mutts team goes everywhere. We have a Barks and Books program at the library. We have, which has won some awards.
Well, you're certainly doing something right. I'll tell you, what do you have, 350,000 Facebook followers?
That's the Mutt Militia, correct? Is that what they're called?
Mutt Militia.
It's huge. Yeah. Huge.
And people can help out by following you and being there to, you know, adopt a dog,
a
I suppose.
You can follow up.
Donations?
Donating helps. You can go to marliesmutts.org. Or Marley's Mutt Dog Rescue on Facebook. But yeah, donations help. You know, sharing posts on Facebook helps. Obviously, following us helps. You know, we have an Amazon wish list, which is very helpful. You know, the little things, pee pads and crates. And, you know, we partook in a lot of Wings of Rescue flights. We don't any longer. But so we had needed crates for that. And we need just the little things. You know, we need microchips for all of our spay neuters. So a lot of that stuff's on the Amazon wish list. And you can also do Amazon Smile, where a percentage of every purchase goes to Marley's Mutts. And that adds up, because everybody shops on Amazon.
That's right. And to do that, you just have to select a charity that you want a percentage of your sale to go to?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy. It's relatively self-explanatory. You just Amazon Smile. And we're just trying to evolve. We're just trying to get better and represent the people that follow us. I mean, we're not perfect, and we make mistakes, and we try to hold ourselves accountable and adjust accordingly. Anytime you have this many followers, you're under a microscope, and you get a lot of criticism. I know I have to get thicker skin if I expect to do this for a lifetime. We're hoping to adapt and just keep getting better. My dream is to have a rescue center where people and dogs can come together to rehabilitate and recover together, just like I did with my dogs, just how my dogs provided me with recovery and rehab. I want to have dogs and people side by side in a, whether it's alcoholism, drug addiction, post-traumatic stress, any type of abuse that they've been through that requires, you know, a program. I want to have people living alongside dogs as they rehabilitate, because there's so many things you can learn from dogs to help you get out of your own ego, you know, to help you physically get better from just a physical standpoint. Dogs will teach you how to be compassionate. They'll teach you how to love again. They'll teach you how to trust, because you have to get their trust in order to be effective. So one day, my dream is to have some kind of a rescue ranch where humans and doggies getting better together can happen.
And that would be awesome.
And you will succeed.
Now, we're going to let you go in a second here, but I just had one last question, because I want to know how you're doing now today. Zach, you said that you felt like a throwaway human at one time, and that's why you could relate to these dogs who are throwaway dogs. How do you feel today after working and doing as much as you have for the dogs?
I feel pretty good. You know, when you have a character defect like insecurity or hypersensitivity, when you don't think much of yourself, but that's all you can think about, it's hard to break yourself out of that. So I still have, you know, moments where, you know, I have man in the mirror complex, I guess, where I have a tough time. You know, I have a tough time being okay with myself. You know, it's leaps and bounds better than it was, but I still have, you know, lapses of where I lack confidence, I lack the self-esteem needed to push through the day, and I have to press the reset button and try and breathe and start over. But it's nowhere near what it was like before. I'm almost 7 years sober, and you know, everything is different, and my life is nothing like it used to be. My insecurities aren't what they used to be. My dependencies aren't what they used to be. And, I mean, I have my comprehensive transplant review August 3rd, which is every year. Every 6 months I got to go over imaging, ultrasound, endoscopy, blood work, biopsy if necessary, and they, you know, see how we're doing. Just see if I've gotten better, if I'm getting worse, or just keep an eye on me. And I have no doubt that that'll be a successful review, and they'll again be kind of astonished that I'm doing good.
That's good to hear.
Your story
answers the question for a lot of people who might be wondering why do this, why take the time, but you get a lot out of it too. So, and you've been very honest about that. You've gotten as much as you've given, or at least
absolutely.
You did.
I would be dead without my dogs for sure. I mean, I have no question about it. The other thing is, you know, they provide a constant reminder on the work you need to do. They're a living, breathing, constant example of being in the moment. And I think that's one of our biggest problems as human beings is culturally, financially, spiritually, we're kind of encouraged to live in yesterday or tomorrow. My sponsor always says if you're thinking about yesterday or tomorrow, you're pissing on your future. And, or if you got one leg in the past and one leg in the future, you're pissing on your future on today. And it sounds pretty graphic and ridiculous, but that's the one thing I get from my dogs on a daily basis is that if I want to restart, if I want to decide to be in the day, in the moment, at any point during the day, I can stop and do it. I don't have to be caught up in all that mindless nonsense that happens in between my ears, you know?
Mm-hmm. Live in the moment.
Well, Zach, we wish you much luck. I know Janie's looking to the future and possibly being one of those dog adopters.
I follow you hard, Zach. I do.
Right.
And I know a lot of people are out there waiting for your dogs because of what you're doing and putting them out there in front of them on your Facebook. And that's a great place for them to go and follow you. And like you said, share it and get the word out so that they can find homes for the dogs. There, you can go to marliesmutts.com and donate. There's a donation page. .org. Okay. Yeah, marliesmutts.org. And you can donate there and find out all about them. There's lots of pictures and videos and all kinds of fun stuff. And it's going to be fun to watch how this grows. I hope that you realize your dream that you can do some rehabilitation right there, some facility where the people and the dogs can come together, because that is so powerful what it's done for you and for me. And I think Janie can say the same thing for herself. We've all experienced it. And, you know, it's hopefully everybody else can too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just so much to learn from and so much to be gained with the human-canine bond. It's really endless.
It's a gift. They are a gift to human beings.
Zach.
Well, Zach, thank you.
It's been real nice talking to you guys.
It's been nice talking to you, too. Thanks for coming on. You have a great day out there.
Yeah, you guys, too. Bye.
Zach, thank you.
Bye. Okay, that was Zach Scow of Marley's Mutts, marliesmutts.org, marliesmutts.org. And if you type in Marley's Mutts, you will find all kinds of things on the internet about them, not just their website. It'll come right up, though. I've done it. And you'll also find other interviews that Zach has done and video interviews included in that. So there's so many ways you can help. Now, we were going to have another guest on today from Heath's Haven Dog Rescue, Jolene and Sean Heath. They are close to us in our area, and they have a rescue and sanctuary that specializes in special needs dogs, the ones that are really spinal injuries. Now, Zach, when we were getting on the show, he was talking about one of their dogs, and he was telling the story about how just recently, 2 weeks ago, that dog couldn't even crawl, couldn't do anything, and they got him attached to a wheelchair, and once the dog started moving again, a lot of memory muscle and everything started happening. After 2 weeks of rehabilitation, the dog is now walking. So it went from not being able to walk at all to walking under Zach's care at Marley's Mutts. Now, they've got some dogs that, you know, they don't have legs, and so they have mobility issues at Heath's Haven. And so they have a great rescue. Unfortunately, they're not going to be on today because there's a wildfire in our area and it's consumed 2,000 acres, and their facility happens to be one of the facilities threatened today. But we do have a little clip that we're going to play as we go out. It's Cooper's story. Cooper was a dog that they found. It was a pit bull, and his injuries were so severe he couldn't crawl. He'd just been abandoned on the side of the road down in Riverside, California. And the facility there, the animal shelter, found him, rehabilitated him to the best they could. And then, of course, they had to find a place they could send him. And Heath's Haven is the place where they sent him.
Yeah, I bet. I met Cooper last week.
Did you really?
Yeah, he's a fabulous dog.
Well, that's really cool. So there's so much going on. There's so many ways you can help. And the thing about it is you will be helped, too, as Zach told us with his story and shared with us. I think we've all been helped through really, really hard times with the help of some of our animals. For us, horses and dogs have really been a help to us. But dogs, they just love human beings, so trusting of human beings. It's like they just have that ingrained in their spirits to trust and love and give back. So I'm going to go ahead and play Cooper's story, and then that'll be it for today. Again, marliesmutts.org or Facebook, Marley's Mutts.
I was desperate for help, and you know, he clearly needed an answer, and he needed one quickly. And my pit bull rescues in San Diego unfortunately couldn't take him, so I reached out to one of my other pit bull rescues who has a lot of contacts, and I just asked her, hey, can you post this little guy on your Facebook page and see if we can find him a really special rescue. And so she did, and within a couple hours, I think his video had over 10,000 views. So, you know, people share, and then the other people share, and then their friends share. And somewhere along the line, Heath's Haven up in Idaho saw his story and contacted me yesterday.
What is it called?
Heath's Haven.
Heath's Haven.
And they do nothing but special needs animals. They deal specifically with either dogs with neurological issues or dogs that who have been in car accidents and need wheelchairs. They're pretty much all wheelchair babies over there.
Bye, buddy. Have a good life, buddy.
Say thanks, everybody, for taking such good care of me. Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on Talk About with Rez and Andy, live every Monday at 3 p.m. Please join us next week for another great show. And please call in and share your thoughts and opinions. Also, look for us and like us on Facebook and Twitter, and follow our show page on BTR.